Hi, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome to Women's Voices. Here we are already in the first month of 2012, that auspicious date that has been dangling before our eyes for lo these many years. Amazing, isn't it, that we've arrived? Before I play my music, They Are Innocent, I'd like to share something that I'm feeling excited about. I've sung all of my life. I'm 78, so that's a few years. And for the past 8 years, I've played my own music, almost exclusively, dedicated to the return of the sacred feminine, in great gratitude that I could share it with you. I've also sung from time to time in churches and religious centers in our little community. I'm a member of a listserv of an international matriarchal studies group, which will be presenting a conference, a matriarchal studies conference in San Francisco, held at Fisherman's Wharf in May, open to all. And I will be presenting my sacred music, so I'm very excited about that. If you'd like to know more, get more information, feel free to call me. I'm in the phone book, or my email address is jreisner, R-E-Z-N-E-R, at mcn.org. And now, They Are Innocent, dedicated to all those, human and animal alike, who are being brutalized, suffering, and starving in this patriarchal world.
My children. time for you to see what is happening. Look around you.
We have a wonderful show before us with our guest, Judy Holland, board-certified psychiatrist specializing in psychopharmacology. Julie has spent her adult life investigating drugs. At the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Holland majored in the biological basis of behavior, a series of courses combining the study of psychology and neurosciences with a concentration in drugs and the brain, or psychopharmacology. During her college years, she authored an extensive research paper on MDMA, ecstasy, resulting in 3 television appearances. In 1992, Dr. Holland received her medical degree from Temple University School of Medicine, where she performed research on auditory hallucinations, extensively interviewing nearly 100 psychotic patients. In 1994, she received the Outstanding Resident Award from the National Institute of Mental Health. As an assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine, Julie spent her weekends running the psychiatric emergency room at Bellevue Hospital for 9 years, and out of that has come her book, Weekends at Bellevue. She is considered an expert on street drugs and intoxication states and lectures widely on this topic, has been quoted in Time, Harper's, Slate, the LA Times, and the Wall Street Journal. Holland has appeared as a medical expert regarding mental illness and drug use on numerous television shows, including Today and Good Morning America, and speaks on various topics on YouTube. Her interest in MDMA as a therapeutic agent led her to author an extensive research paper, forensic consultations, and a book, Ecstasy, The Complete Guide, a comprehensive look at the risks and benefits of MDMA, considered to be the first comprehensive and authoritative book on MDMA, which explores its use to treat psychiatric and medical conditions. She has also written 2 articles for the Quarterly Journal of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Drugs, MAPS, M-A-P-S, a consortium of international hallucinogen researchers. The first detailed a survey of ecstasy and other drugs used at New York City raves. Julie was recently part of a panel discussion, Psychedelic Healing, Can Psychedelics Reinvent Medicine and Society, at the 2011 International Drug Policy Reform Conference in November, held by MAPS. Her most recent book is The Pot Book, A Complete Guide to Cannabis. She also writes and speaks about the millions of Americans subjugated by the U.S. government's 40-year, $1 trillion social catastrophe, the war on drugs, which puts a human face on a failed policy underscored by fear, politics, racial prejudice, and intolerance in a public atmosphere of out of sight, out of mind. More about this can be found on exilenation.org. More than anything, she is respected for her frankness, honesty, and compassion. Dr. Harland runs a private practice in New York City and lives with her husband and two children in the Hudson Valley. Toward the end of the show, Dr. Harland will answer your questions regarding psychiatric medications or complaints or diagnoses. Welcome, Julie, to Women's Voices.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Good. Even though it's kind of late for you, I appreciate it a lot.
It's okay. The kids are in bed, and it started to snow, so it's actually kind of lovely here right now.
Oh.
We haven't had any snow yet, so it's the first snowfall of the year. It's happening very late.
You know, it hasn't been raining here either, so I understand that situation. And how wonderful. This sounds beautiful. My first question is, given that this is Women's Voices, is what part did your mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Oh, pretty huge part, I would say.
I bet.
I mean, you know, my mom, you know, when I was growing up, first and foremost, she was a science teacher. And she's really an educator and a communicator. But she instilled in me a love in science and chemistry and biology. But I also really got her gift for communicating and explaining things to people. And she also is terribly empathic. I mean, she really connects deeply with people. And she's the one who actually, you know, saw what I was interested in and helped sort of point me in the right direction. I was always, you know, interested in the brain and the mind and drugs and behavior. And she's the one who sort of explained, you know, that I could study something called neurobiology or biopsychology when I went off to college. And I ended up actually choosing University of Pennsylvania because they had this major called the Biological Basis of Behavior, which was all about biopsych and neuropsych and psychopharmacology. So, you know, before I even got to med school, I knew an awful lot about psychiatry and psychiatric drugs because I'd been studying them for 4 years in undergrad. But I think that also my mom, you know, if she were growing up in a different time, I think she would have been a doctor. A lot of people told her she couldn't be a doctor, but she could be a nurse, and somehow she was sort of turned off by that and ended up doing neither. So it's possible that I was slyly pushed in a certain direction by her. But the other thing I remember is my mom saying that she was very afraid of drugs, and drugs scared her, and she didn't really understand them well. And I think as a way to sort of assert myself independently from her or show her that I wasn't afraid, I ended up learning a lot about drugs and not being afraid of them and really wanting to understand them. But I always sort of keep in mind that for a lot of people, drugs scare them. And I think that's definitely one of the things that's going on with our government, is that, you know, drug use is subversive, and the government gets very nervous when people start expanding their consciousness or thinking outside the box.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful beginning. That's so lovely that you had that start. That's certainly a leg up.
Yeah, she absolutely gave me a leg up.
Yes, yes, and you know, your ability to communicate and that she could do that with you, that's just how special, how very wonderful, really.
So I also grew up in a house of music. Sounds like you might have done that too.
I did.
I appreciate that you're still performing and writing music. I find that very inspiring. I've always, you know, before I could speak, I was singing, and my mother is a musician, and out of the three daughters that she had, I was sort of the most musical and really bonded with her over, you know, being able to carry a tune or being able to sing harmony. And she always encouraged me to be a musician. And from like 6th, 7th grade on, I was always in bands or in rock bands and fronting bands. I played trumpet, and then I switched over to guitar.
Uh-huh.
But even up until 3rd year med school, I mean, all through college and med school, I was still singing in bands and sort of trying to, you know, study for my med school exams in between recording or gigs or things like that. And I finally had to really sort of give up, you know, the idea of being a professional musician when I was going to med school. And in like 3rd year of med school, I couldn't do both anymore. I had to finally quit the band. But, you know, the interesting thing that's happened lately is I've started playing music again with my family, with my children and with my husband, and we formed like a family band.
How?
So I hope to be a good musical influence on my daughter as well and keep that chain going.
Yes. Oh, that's just wonderful. Really, that's lovely. Singing with your children is just wonderful. I did that with mine as well. And yeah, we all sang, and my mother would visit us, and we'd all sing harmonize with each other.
Yeah, that's just lovely.
It is.
I really enjoy doing that with my kids.
Yeah. As they grew older, you know, these things kind of melt away, which is sad, but...
Yeah.
So keep it going.
As long as I can, I will.
Yes. So I guess the I was going to ask your statement about you spent your adult life investigating drugs, but I kind of understand why, given your background and how you grew up. You know, I would love to hear about I'm sure everyone would, your, at least a small part of your weekends at Bellevue. What a learning experience that must have been.
It certainly was. I mean, you know, when I was in medical school, I was doing research on auditory hallucinations. Then when I was a resident, I was doing research on schizophrenia. And I've always been drawn to insanity and psychosis. And I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that always interested me about LSD or psilocybin, you know, mushrooms, is that you could take such a small dose of something and really, you know, get a little crazy. You know, not totally out of control, but, you know, the borders between things would sort of melt away, and you would make associations where you wouldn't before. And the thing that always intrigued me about talking to somebody who was, you know, in a psychotic episode, whether they were schizophrenic or whether they were having a manic episode, I was always interested to see, you know, what they would talk about, what sort of connections they would make. I mean, when somebody is manic, you know, their speech gets very sort of pressured and overproduced, and, you know, they talk a lot. They're saying a lot of really interesting things, and they're sort of going from step to step to step, and, you know, it's a little bit like going from rock to rock when you're trying to cross a pond. You know, you got to kind of keep up with them to see what the connection was. You know, it's a little bit like really great poetry. But the other thing that I would notice about people who would come into Bellevue when they were in a manic phase is that they kind of reminded me of my tripping friends from high school. You know, they'd be laughing and they'd be crying and they would have these huge insights and feel very, you know, omnipotent or powerful, or, you know, I finally understand it. Everything has fallen into place and it all makes sense. And I just remember thinking over and over again how much the epiphanies that you can get in a manic episode look similar to the kind of epiphanies you get from nitrous or from psilocybin or from LSD. I always thought, you know, all these altered states are so interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the drag with our nation's drug policy is that very little research really gets done into all this fascinating stuff. You know, there's such a taboo about studying these drugs or studying the altered states that they engender. And it's really a shame because we're missing out on a lot of knowledge that could help people who've got psychiatric illness and, you know, lots of people who are just struggling in general. I mean, you know, one of the things that I'm involved in now is I'm the medical monitor for a study giving MDMA to people with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
And particularly the veterans that are coming from the Iraq and Afghan wars. I mean, I'm sure everybody's been reading the headlines. There's a lot of PTSD, and there are just, you know, thousands of suicides happening and homicides and arsons. And, you know, people are coming back from these wars, and they're in really bad shape. And
yeah.
MDMA-assisted psychotherapy has really been shown to be very helpful in post-traumatic stress disorder. And we've got a study going on at Medical University of South Carolina treating people with post-traumatic stress disorder, and specifically veterans. So I didn't mean to veer away from Bellevue. I could tell you lots of Bellevue
stories. Right. No, I think this is really, we certainly do want to talk about this. Before you continue, though, I saw a video of the event at MAPS, at the mm-hmm. panel discussion, and you spoke briefly and poignantly about the man that came in at Bellevue with the tattoos.
Yeah, I mean, this was a guy who I had seen many, many times. He was a sort of beefy thug of a man who was very highly tattooed and just a huge guy, really menacing, a scary guy. And a lot of times when he was brought in to the psych ER at Bellevue, he was either drunk and very agitated and screaming and scary, or more often he was high on PCP, where he was really screaming and agitated, and you know, you could not talk with him. There was really nothing else to do except sedate him and put him down in a cot and hope when he woke up in 8 hours, you know, you could get something out of him. But this one time he came in when I was working, and he was like a whole different guy, and he was smiling, and he was very approachable, and I could finally, like, have a conversation with him. His pupils were dilated, and when I asked him what he was on, because it clearly wasn't PCP and it wasn't alcohol, it turned out that he had bought some ecstasy, and he was high on MDMA. And you know, it was a good opportunity to actually get some therapy done, because when this guy comes in and he's agitated on PCP, it's not like I can have a talk with him about his childhood.
You know,
but this was really a tremendous opportunity to get some actual therapeutic work done, and I really was able to have a connection with him.
The thing you said that amazed me was that if he hadn't had the tattoos to recognize him with, you wouldn't have known it was him.
It was a completely different guy, you know. I'm sorry to use this word, but it's Mendocino. I think you guys can handle it. It was like his aura had completely changed. It was the first time that he ever got any actual therapy or, you know, real assistance in that psych ER. And I know that it's pretty out there to think about MDMA-assisted psychotherapy in a psychiatric emergency room, in an emergency situation. But, you know, one of the things that MDMA is very good at is helping people be hopeful, have some hope for the future, and sort of set out a path and a goal where they want to go. And I think it may be very helpful at interrupting suicidal thoughts and feelings, which is a big issue when you're working in the psych ER.
Well, you said on the panel discussion that he was able to finally open up about his horrific childhood abuse.
Right. Well, the thing about Bellevue is everybody's got horrific childhood abuse. Mm-hmm. It got to the point, you know, when somebody would present a case to me and they would start to go on about the patient's horrible childhood, and I was like, I got it. Don't worry. You know, it's just a given that one of the reasons why the people coming in are crack addicted or drinking themselves to death is that they need a childhood transplant. They need to start over in a non-chaotic home with two loving parents who are committed to raising a calm, centered, happy child. And most of the people that I saw at Bellevue just didn't have anything like that, and that's one of the basic problems.
So they're just trying to medicate themselves to death so
they
won't feel it.
And even, you know, a lot of people in this country have depression or bipolar depression or panic disorder. You know, they've got some sort of psychiatric diagnosis, but they're still pretty functional and doing okay. They take their medicine. They have jobs and families. You know, the people who are really falling through the cracks, who are horribly ill, are the ones who've got psychiatric diagnoses and they're abusing substances and they've got these just horrendous childhoods and families and social situations. Mm-hmm. And they don't have good social support. So it was a pretty depressing place, Bellevue, I'll tell you.
But I can imagine.
You know, what was great about it, first of all, the people who worked there were lovely. And, they really became my families. I spent more time with them than I did with anybody else. And we grew very close. And a lot of people that go into that work, they are very empathic and they care deeply about people. But they figure out pretty quickly that they're going to get totally burned out if they're all kind of bleeding hearts. And so people end up getting sort of crusty and sealing over a little bit, and everything is a joke and very lighthearted, and you don't take anything too seriously because you cannot last in a place like that if you let it get to you. And I learned, you know, when I first started there that I had to be kind of a cowboy and a hard gal and just have sort of a crust. It's like, you know, a good French bread. I'm pretty mushy underneath, so I learned to develop a pretty hard crust. And after years and years of working at Bellevue, and then I got married, and then I had a kid, and then I had another kid, and then I was in a therapy for a while, and 9/11 happened, and all, you know, all these things kept happening to sort of break down my barriers and break down that crust. And by the end, I couldn't work at Bellevue anymore. I was too maternal, and I just, the recidivism there is just kind of crazy. You see the same people over and over, and they just don't get it. They don't get better.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I can imagine. Well, you certainly did your duty.
I put in my time. Put in my time.
You did. If you want to switch now to MDMA and you became very interested in that, and, you know, I most recently saw you on the panel discussion, which was very interesting. So, yeah, go.
You know, ecstasy is a pretty complicated topic. There's really two sides to it, and you know, there's the recreational ecstasy side, and then there's sort of the medical model of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, and they're really very different. I like to sort of separate the names and call ecstasy, ecstasy. If you are going to a club and you buy a tablet from somebody and you swallow it, it might be MDMA, but it might be any number of other things which are more or less safe than MDMA. And so I call that ecstasy, because you never exactly know what you're getting, and that's just because of our nation's drug laws, that there's drug substitution and you don't know what you're getting. But the recreational model is pretty dangerous because, number one, you have no idea what you're ingesting, and even if it is MDMA, you don't know how much it is. And the tablets can be mixed with things or cut with things, so that's number one the number one danger is drug substitution. And then the number two danger is people getting overheated, dancing for 6 hours at a rave or a club and not taking any breaks. And there's a higher risk of heat stroke with MDMA. And also with a lot of the things that the tablets end up being cut with or drug substitution, there's other chemicals like PMA or PMMA or DXM. I mean, there are things that people put in tablets that sort of seem a little bit like ecstasy, but they're not MDMA, and you end up with a higher risk of heat stroke. So dying from hyperthermia or having severe medical consequences from heat stroke, that would be the number two risk. And then the number three risk is people drinking too much water. It turns out that MDMA causes you to retain a lot of water, and in a premenstrual woman, this is even more exaggerated. So what happens sometimes is people will take a tablet or two tablets, but they're told to drink a lot of water, and they end up drinking so much water that they have a water intoxication. Their sodium levels get very low, and it can kill you drinking too much water. Most people, if they drink a gallon of water, they would pee a gallon of water. But if you've taken MDMA and you drink a gallon of water, you don't urinate out that much, and you end up with this horrible water overload situation, which affects your brain. It basically causes your brain to swell, just called cerebral edema. And you can even sort of drown in the fluid in your lungs. So this is another thing that can kill you, basically, with ecstasy or with MDMA.
Wow. Excuse me 1 second, may I? And say that you're listening to Dr. Julie Holland, psychiatrist, author of Ecstasy, The Complete Guide, A Comprehensive Look at the Risks and Benefits of MDMA.
So in the medical model, you know what you're taking. You know it's MDMA. You know how much it is. It's 125 milligrams, sort of a standard amount that over the years has been shown to help the psychotherapy go deeper and be more effective. You're sitting down, you're talking, you're not dancing for 6 hours. You may be drinking a little bit of water, but you're certainly not going to be, you know, pounding glasses of water. So the top three risks from recreational ecstasy use are not an issue with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. And actually, you know, these are FDA-approved studies. I mean, the government has sort of agreed that, yes, if you're giving a single oral dose, separated by several weeks before you give another dose, if people in the study get either two or three doses over the course of the study, and that's the end of it. And in these studies, there's also a lot of psychotherapy going on between the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy sessions so that people can sort of process what they've figured out and integrate it before they have another session.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of preparation ahead of time before somebody takes MDMA. So the studies are very safe, and they're highly effective. You know, the people, something like 80% of the people who go through these studies, at the end of the study, they don't meet criteria for being in the study anymore. They don't have the symptoms that brought them into the study. And everyone's sort of uncomfortable at using the word cured, you know, but the bottom line is they don't have the diagnosis anymore, so I don't know what else you call it. And then when you measure them 6 months out, 12 months out, they're still doing very well. So it's a way to treat post-traumatic stress disorder without having to take medication every day.
That's wonderful.
You know, sort of getting to the root cause of what's causing the symptoms instead of kind of sweeping them under the rug, which is sort of what medications do.
Yeah. How wonderful. Think how much pain they don't have having gone through the study, really.
It is. It's sort of like a psychic pain reliever, I think, is one way of thinking about it.
There are then other studies that kind of measure one's spiritual experience, aren't there?
The really great spirituality studies that I think are happening right now are Johns Hopkins using psilocybin. The Johns Hopkins studies are using psilocybin. Originally, they were just using it in healthy, normal, controlled people who weren't sick, who had active spiritual lives. So these are people like priests or Buddhists, people who were meditating, and they gave them psilocybin and showed that they could reliably induce a spiritual peak experience in these people, and they would, the subjects were rating it as, you know, one of the most important experiences of their lives, very profoundly moving spiritually. And now I think the Johns Hopkins group is using psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy to treat the anxiety and pain associated with end-stage cancer patients.
Yes.
That's also something that's going on with my colleagues at NYU. One little correction I wanted to make is that I didn't author the ecstasy book. I'm the editor. It's also true for the pot book that I edited the book, and there's about 40 or 50 other people who've contributed to the book who are the real authors.
I see.
You know, in both books, first of all, they're both nonprofit projects, these books. All the proceeds fund clinical research. The profit book would be the Weekends at Bellevue book. So with both these books, these are both Schedule I drugs, MDMA and cannabis. They're both illegal, but they're both potentially therapeutic and medicinal. And I think that's why I was drawn to doing these nonprofit projects. Just want to try to help turn things around a little bit. I feel like our government's drug policy, it's inaccurate. It doesn't really make any sense. I mean, when you look at the drugs that are scheduled and the drugs that aren't, I mean, most people would agree that alcohol and cigarettes are, if you really look at them, they meet criteria for Schedule I, that they're addictive and they don't really have any medicinal value. And then you've got things that are in Schedule I, like MDMA or cannabis, which really are medicinal and do have proven therapeutic efficacy, but they're listed in a classification that says that they don't have any medicinal use at all.
I know.
So it's kind of frustrating.
Very much so.
And I feel, I think that things are slowly coming around and slowly changing. I'm obviously not very happy with our federal government's recent response to all the dispensaries in California. I mean, everybody thought it was going to be okay, and all of a sudden it's not okay, and it's hard to understand why, what changed, what's going on.
Right, right. Yes, it doesn't make any sense at all. I hope that some way we can turn it around. I think I'm back to that panel discussion that I was so taken with at MAPS, talking about what right does anybody have to tell you what you can and cannot feel, or explore in terms of consciousness, it seems.
Yeah.
And that the other thing I thought was very interesting is that, and I think, I don't know if this is talking about psilocybin or ecstasy or both, is that it isn't that they give you these experiences, is it that they quell the anxiety that doesn't allow you to feel these insights and have them in ordinary consciousness. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways I think about MDMA-assisted psychotherapy is it's a little bit like anesthesia during surgery, that it really allows you to sort of dig deep and get down to that malignant thing that has to be removed. When you do normal psychotherapy, it takes years and years, and, it's like peeling away the layers of an onion, and it fits and starts. And as you get closer to the stuff that really matters, you get kind of defended, and you don't want to come to therapy anymore, and, you start making jokes and avoiding things. It takes forever to really get down to what you need to. With MDMA, people are really kind of opened up, and, they're available. I mean, the metaphor I like to use is it's like a house with all the lights on and all the doors unlocked. It's kind of up to you where you want to open and look into, but you've got enough light and you feel strong enough that you really can explore some of the scary places. And with post-traumatic stress disorder, it's hard for people to process the trauma because they're so anxious about processing the trauma and they're fearful. But MDMA really acutely lowers your anxiety and your fear response. And you can see this physiologically with where there's less blood flow going to the amygdala, which is sort of where people get very fearful and reactive. And not only are people less anxious, but because their brains are really flooded with serotonin, they're relaxed, they're comfortable, if they're not happy, they're at least sort of, content and peaceful. And that combination, that satiety and feeling like you don't need anything and having all this low anxiety, the other thing that happens is that you have a stronger sort of sense of trust with your therapist. You've got higher oxytocin levels, so you feel this sort of social bonding with your therapist, and you trust them, and you feel like they're really trying to help you. So it strengthens something called the therapeutic alliance, which is feeling like you and the therapist are on the same team, that you're allies and you're working together. And that's one of the highest predictors of success of psychotherapy, is a therapeutic alliance. So, you couldn't design a better drug, basically, to be used during therapy. I mean, it's a stimulant, so people are very awake, they're alert, they're not sort of all drugged out and slurring their words. Because it's this amphetamine base, they have increased concentration and attention, and they have increased memory. They've got memory for the traumatic events, but they have memory for the therapy session also. So they don't, it's not like, you come out with these insights, but then they sort of, they're like sand through your fingers and you can't quite remember what you grasp. I mean, you have full recollection for the entire therapy session and for the trauma. So you know, you really couldn't design pharmacologically a better sort of catalyst for therapy to go deeper and be more efficient and more effective.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn Howell, who's...
Yeah.
Yes, who I interviewed her, and it was end of life, you know, for her daughter that... I'm not recalling if it was mushrooms or ecstasy.
Well,
at the end.
This is a book called Honor Thy Daughter, and
right.
they actually did more than one substance. I think that they did MDMA, and
yeah.
they also, I believe, did psilocybin as well.
Right, and a little cannabis on the side, too, yeah. But I've forgotten which one was so relieved that she liked the best at the very end, the daughter. But anyway, it was a remarkable the shift that it created and the release of pain for everyone.
Yeah. You know, she's a really moving speaker, Marilyn. I thought she did a great job.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that was a Drug Policy Alliance conference. It was co-sponsored. It was a Drug Policy Alliance and MAPS co-sponsored this event.
I see.
And it was a great conference.
And MAPS is in San Jose, right? I think so.
They are.
Yeah.
It's anybody wants to go to maps.org and they can learn more about MAPS.
How do you do this in your own practice?
Well, I can't.
Well, that's what
answer.
I was, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's sort of the bottom line is that I, you know, because it's a Schedule I drug, I cannot perform MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. So what I do is I help researchers. I mean, I do a lot of fundraising and I try to get researchers money. I mean, I'm helping the NYU psilocybin study and... I've been able to donate a good amount to the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy research because of the ecstasy book. So I do fundraising, and I'm the medical monitor for some of the studies, so I make sure that they're conducting the studies safely.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoy working with the principal investigator of the MDMA psychotherapy studies is a guy named Michael Midhoffer, and he's an ER doctor and an internist and a psychiatrist, and his wife is an ER nurse. And they work as a team, as a husband-wife team, conducting the therapy. And it's,
you
know, they put in a lot of hours. These guys work really hard. But I'm very happy to be, you know, a part of the team and helping to ensure medical safety. But in my private practice, you know, I can't, I don't really talk about ecstasy very much. And I, you know, I talk about pot a little bit. But, you know, in New York, I can't make any recommendations. We are not a medical marijuana state. And we have a very dysfunctional legislature. And there's been a push to be a medical cannabis state for the past 10 years, and it's just gone nowhere, unfortunately.
Nice. Oh.
So, yeah. You know, my private practice has really evolved. I mean, I'm actually working my fourth book right now is a book I'm working on about women and depression, and it's called Moody Bitches. It's about this idea that women are really... very naturally emotional, naturally reactive and empathic, and we sort of have to be empathic if we're going to be good caretakers. You know, we have to know whether our children are hungry or in pain, and we have to know whether our men are dangerous or going to leave us. And so, you know, we've got these fluctuating hormone levels, and we're not static. We're very dynamic. And I think what's happening now is that a lot of women are really medicating away their emotionality and how dynamic they are. You know, they're on the pill, so they have steady hormone levels, and they don't ovulate, and they're taking antidepressants so that they don't well up and get emotional a few days before their periods. And one of the things I work with women a lot is figuring out, you know, do you really need to take all these medicines, and can we clean this up a little bit, and, you know, can you find other ways to not get pregnant besides suppressing ovulation and tricking your body into thinking it already is pregnant? So I'm in this phase of work now in private practice where I'm really trying to get people to take less medicine and just to be more natural and to sort of honor their natures more.
Good for you. Yes, indeed. I want to know how can people get your books? Let's get that out of the way first.
Well, there's, you know, if you go to weekendsatbellevue.com or thepopbook.com, you can learn more about these books. And or drholland.com. I've got all sorts of websites. And, you know, they're all available on Amazon. You know, the Ecstasy Book and the Pop Book are, they're nonprofit projects.
And you have, you have many YouTubes on YouTube.
Do I?
Yeah,
okay.
You do. Yeah, well, yeah, you've talked about the pot book and the, talking about the government suppression of of drugs.
And yeah, I did an interview on this movie called Exile Nation. That's probably on YouTube.
Yes, exilenation.org. People, just Google you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I tell people is that, you know, if you just Google Julie Ecstasy, you'll see a bunch of my stuff.
Julie Ecstasy. Okay, great. We haven't really talked very much about the pot book and about pot and all of its wonderful qualities. We also, I said that if people wanted to call in and ask questions, is that okay?
Yeah, I'm always happy to do Q&A. I mean, that's my favorite part. You know, I give lectures all the time, and when they tell me they want me to speak for 45 minutes or something, I always want to speak for like 20 or 25, because I'd rather just do half talking and half questions. I'm always happy to be, you know, Johnny on the spot and try to come up with something. Well, one of the things I loved about Bellevue is that I had to, like, very quickly, you know, meet somebody and ask them a bunch of questions and just really figure out what was going on with them without having a lot of other information. And I enjoy that.
Good. Well, maybe we'll have something happen here.
Yeah, if anybody wants a free consultation.
This is your moment.
Not typically what I offer.
The studio line is 707-937-5103, and you're invited to call in. In the meantime, but you have two children.
I do. I have a daughter named Molly, who's 11, and a son named Joe, who is 7. And Molly is in that lovely quiescent latency phase still that Freud talked about before all hell breaks loose. I'm really trying to enjoy these last few, you know, precious moments before the volatility comes.
Well, maybe it won't come. We have a call. Good evening. You're on Women's Voices.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine.
Yeah.
Can you tell me
a little bit more about 5-HTP?
Absolutely.
I've been taking it because I have low serotonin, and my therapist told me that it was good to help with my depression.
Absolutely, yeah.
I wonder if there's any negative effects for long-term taking it. Thank you.
Well, anybody's figured out yet, is all, you know, in terms of long-term effects. I mean, you know, people have been taking tryptophan or 5-hydroxytryptophan, which is what 5-HTP is, for, you know, 25, 30 years, and, it, you know, there was like one or two bad batches of tryptophan back in the day that sort of freaked everybody out. But aside from it being, you know, very rarely contaminated, there doesn't seem to be any downside. I mean, when you eat a lot of turkey, it increases your levels of tryptophan. It's one of the reasons why you get so exhausted around Thanksgiving, but it's more than that. So 5-HTP is the second step to becoming serotonin. It goes tryptophan, 5-hydroxytryptophan, which is 5-HTP, and then the next step in the chemical equation is it goes to 5-hydroxytryptamine, which is what serotonin is. So tryptophan, which is an amino acid, a piece of a protein, that is a building block of serotonin. And what people can do is they can either take regular tryptophan, which typically comes in 500 milligram tablets, and you can take 1, 2, or 3 of them at night to help you sleep and help you boost serotonin levels, or you can take 5-HTP, 50 milligrams or 100 milligrams, 2 or 3 times a day. You usually have to take it with food, otherwise it can upset your stomach. The most you should take is 103 times a day, and the lowest dose would be 50 milligrams once a day. So anywhere between 50 and 300, you have to kind of figure out where you start getting more happy and relaxed. But it's an absolute kind of do-it-yourself alternative to the SSRIs, to the antidepressants that increase serotonin. And what's nice about taking tryptophan or 5-HTP is you don't get the side effects like you do from the SSRIs. You know, when you take an antidepressant, a lot of them cause weight gain, and almost all of them decrease your libido and make it harder to achieve orgasm, to climax. So these, you know, this is called the sexual side effects. And with tryptophan or 5-HTP, you don't get the sexual side effects. You don't get the weight gain. So it's sort of a better way to go for a lot of people.
Thank you. That sounded very helpful. I hope she heard all that. I'm sure she did. You just mentioned earlier the Johns Hopkins is recruiting folks for a study with life-threatening cancer and are experiencing anxiety or depression. Here's another call. We'll get back to this. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Great show.
Thank you.
So I'm wondering, what would be the closest natural source of MDMA? Would it be like psilocybin or pot or?
Well, you know, MDMA is really unique. I mean, it absolutely floods the brain with serotonin, but also dopamine to some extent. So, you know, psilocybin does something totally different, and cannabis does something totally different. Mm-hmm. So the closest natural compound to MDMA is nutmeg and safrole. But most people can't keep down enough nutmeg to have a real psychoactive effect.
What?
It tends to make you vomit. Safrole is S-A-F-F-R-O-L-E, and it's an organic compound. It's similar to what's in sassafras. It's much closer in chemistry to sassafras.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you know, the bottom line is there really isn't any... I see what you're getting at, though, because the thing that a lot of people don't like about ecstasy is it's synthetic. It's not from nature, and I totally agree with you. You look at something like psilocybin or cannabis that, you know, grows out of the earth, and we've co-evolved with these plants, you know, from the very beginning. And if you believe in God, then God put them there. If your higher power is nature, then nature designed them. But, you know, we don't have that with ecstasy. It is a synthetic.
I'm just super sensitive, and so if I can get the whole thing. And then are there vegetarian sources for this tryptophan?
Bananas and milk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then one other question I had was, I was curious, if we don't have access here to those kind of therapies, I was thinking about how you thought a group situation would be, and if you worked with groups like in Bellevue, where you were dealing with people that had been through, grew up with a lot of abuse, did they trigger each other, or was that
therapeutic
context?
I think, you know, it can definitely go either way. I mean, I think, you know, you get a group of trauma survivors together, and if they've all been in the same trauma, then I think, like, for instance, a group of Vietnam vets, you know, I worked at the VA for years and years, and the vets would sit down and start sharing, and, oh, that happened to me, and, you know, there was a lot of bonding and connection, a sense of community, and mm-hmm. I'm not crazy, and you're going through this too, and that's all great. On the other hand, it's some people who've got a history of, for instance, childhood sexual abuse can have pretty chaotic, disorganized personalities.
Yeah.
They can be very provocative and very dramatic. And then if you've got a group of people who are provocative and dramatic, it gets kind of chaotic and abusive and crazy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it can go either way. You know, it doesn't appeal to my sense of efficiency to have to wait my turn. You know, if you're in a group of 12 people and everybody's got to process their trauma, it's going to take too long.
Yeah.
You know, one-on-one is quicker. It's more efficient.
Yeah.
But I do think that... a lot of people can bond over shared experience, and that can be therapeutic.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling. Could you say again how people can find you?
Well, drholland.com is one way, and weekendsatbellevue.com would be another,
mm-hmm.
and thepotbook.com would be another. So all kinds of ways. And then you can Google Julie Ecstasy. You know, one thing I want to say about the cannabis studies is I'm also the medical monitor of a study giving cannabis to veterans of the Afghan and Iraq war who've got post-traumatic stress disorder. So not just an MDMA study, but a cannabis study.
Mm-hmm.
But what we are unfortunately meeting with is a lot of resistance from the government and a lot of stalling and kind of game playing, where the FDA has approved the study, NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, they won't release the cannabis for the study.
Wow.
So, you know, we're hitting sort of a roadblock with them.
Wow. I'm sorry to hear that.
Not unusual.
We have another call. Here we go. Good evening. You're on Women's Voices.
Yeah, I called earlier about the 5-HTP,
mm-hmm.
and I forgot to ask you. I saw a website where it said that long-term use can cause heart damage. So I was wondering, is it safe to take it, like, over a long time?
I don't know if you remember the Fen-Phen sort of problem that they had, but that there are, it is true that some highly serotonergic drugs can damage the valves of the heart. I have never seen that associated with 5-HTP or with tryptophan. And it doesn't typically happen with the SSRIs, but combinations of serotonergic drugs, like fen-phen. I mean, fenfluramine in particular, I think, can damage those valves. So I haven't seen that that's an issue.
Okay, because, you know, I feel better taking it, and I'd hate to have to stop for any kind of reason like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, the other things that can really help you feel better, and do not underestimate the power of oxygen to get you to feel better. I mean, this is why cardio, one of the reasons why cardio helps so much is that you're just getting more oxygen to your brain. But anytime you think of it, to take very deep, slow breaths and to just really think about getting a lot of oxygen into your bloodstream and into your brain, that can help your mood. Cardio is great for your mood. Sunshine is very good for your mood. And getting out in nature. You know, there are other things that you can do besides pills that can make you feel better.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Okay.
So I'm very big on nature therapy now.
Yeah.
I treat people in the city, you know, and their body is like, you know, jacked into their screens and their cubicles with their fluorescent light, and they're not getting sun, and they're not getting exercise, and they're not getting human touch. They're not out, you know, everybody's on their computers, just punched over, and, you know, they come into my office and they're stressed out and exhausted. And pale, they don't understand why their vitamin D levels are low, and, you know, they don't understand why they feel so lousy, and, you know, they're so disconnected with nature and with what's natural for them. You know, we've, this technology, I mean, I'm all for some of it, but it's really cutting into what's natural for us as primates, as social animals.
Here's another call. Good evening, you're on Women's Voices.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to get your guest comment on a thought that I've been having while listening to the program. I'm thinking that that we are living in a time and culture of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it doesn't take a Bellevue or any other inner-city psych ward to kind of point that out. You know, there's this epidemic of horrendous physical, sexual, emotional abuse towards children, towards women, that's just ongoing and endemic in our culture. And I am presently rereading Alice Miller's classic, The Drama of the Gifted Child and the Search for the True Self. It's a beautiful book, very difficult book, really beautiful book. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts on her, what was groundbreaking and still is groundbreaking work.
I mean, I think that is a really important book. And I do absolutely think that we are collectively, repeatedly traumatized. I think, you know, just reading the news is traumatic. You know, I think especially for women who are empathic, you know, you open the newspaper and there's a picture on the front page of a mother holding her dead baby in her arms from an earthquake in China. You know, you feel that on some level. It traumatizes you on some level. And I think that us being so overexposed to all the catastrophes of the world is really going to raise our cortisol levels. I definitely think that 9/11, you know, I mean, I ran a private practice from 95 until the present, and things really shifted after 9/11. I mean, especially, you know, I was in New York City, where people absolutely were freaked out and very anxious, and everybody all of a sudden sort of gave themselves permission to start medicating themselves and taking Xanax and Clonopin and Ambien. And ever since then, you know, we're at the point now where the women in America, one out of four of us are taking some sort of psychiatric medicine, antidepressant or sleeping pill or anti-anxiety medicine. One out of four.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's just wrong.
And those are some very serious drugs that you...
And they're very serious. And those numbers are even higher in the cities. It's one out of four across the country. But I promise you, in Manhattan, it is higher than one.
Well, you know, here we are in beautiful Mendocino County, and I think we have one of the highest rates of alcoholism and one of the highest rates of child abuse in California.
Well, that's surprising.
And, you know, it's so, you know, I think it's a statement on where we've come, and I think Alice Miller speaks to this so eloquently.
That is a really important book, Drama of a Gifted Child.
Yeah, well, I thank you for bringing the information to us, and thank you, Janie, for having the program, and have a good night.
Thank you. Yeah,
you
Thanks
too.
For calling. Bye. You know, the other thing is what's happening in the climate. I mean, it's very, very serious.
Yeah.
And you know, our time is going away, darn it.
I know. The hour kind of flew by.
It flew by, and we didn't even get to talk about the pot book. So maybe we can do that another time.
Maybe.
I would love that. Thank you so, so much.
And it was my pleasure, Janie.
And many blessings to all your work.
And to you and all your listeners.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Good night. Good night.